Had Clinton done the job those of us who voted for him in 1992 expected him to do, we wouldn't be in the trouble we're in. Imagine if, on his first day in office over 8 years ago, Clinton had ordered a reduction of arsenic in the drinking water, and all Americans had been drinking cleaner, safer water for the last 8 years. Do you think there's any way in hell Junior Bush would have been able to say, "Okay, America, you've been drinking water without poison in it long enough. Time to go back to the good old days of sucking down that old arsenic"? Hell no. No one would have stood for it. And he would have known that. He wouldn't even have tried to reverse things. But because Clinton waited until the last minute and never removed any of this crud from the water or the air, there was no political or popular support for the decision. So it was easy for Bush to do what he did. He figured, you're not going to miss what you never had in the first place. But of course, Bush forgot one thing. Most of us didn't even know we were drinking 1942-level arsenic under Clinton. Thanks to W wanting to make a big deal of reversing Clinton on his first day in office, we, the public, suddenly learned that our water wasn't safe. Now, ask yourself this painful question. Since you never knew or made any noise about the high arsenic levels under Clinton, do you think Gore would have removed the arsenic from the water? Why would he do that? You, the people, never knew about it, never complained to the White House that you hate drinking all this arsenic, and the industries that are responsible for much of that arsenic are some of the same people who funded Gore's campaign. I've looked through all of Gore's campaign literature and position statements, and I've yet to find a single word about arsenic in the water. Let's be honest here. It's only because of Bush and his idiot actions that we're now going to get the arsenic reduced. The whole clamor put the issue in the public's mind, and it hasn't left. So now, 19 Republicans in Congress, feeling the political heat or sensing the PR opportunity, have joined the Democrats in fighting the arsenic. And we, the American people, will end up drinking cleaner water as a result. These 19 Republicans with the Democrats passed a bill not only prohibiting Bush from reversing Clinton's last-minute order, but going beyond what Clinton had ordered and reducing the arsenic levels even further. That didn't happen under Clinton. And trust me, President Gore wouldn't have raised the question. Sad to say, but it was having a prick, not a slick, in the White House that made this happen. Another bad rap Bush got in his first months was his efforts to give our tax money to churches to do charity work. Oh, to you and cry over that one. So here's my question. Where were the People for the American Way and other liberal groups in 1996 when that very language was included in Clinton's welfare reform bill? Faith-based organizations have been receiving federal funds now for more than 5 years. Why all the sudden screaming about separation of church and state when Clinton did what Bush only wants to do more of? Is it because we like Clinton's faith better? Hey, who wouldn't want to join a belief system that redefined works like is? And about that order Bush issued to ban money for abortions overseas. Wrong again. Pro-choice Clinton, like the two presidents before him, had already signed an order prohibiting any American funds from paying for abortions in foreign countries. What Bush did was expand the order to cut off any monies to foreign birth control groups that offer abortion as an alternative. Worse? Yes. But he only got away with it because our Democratic president had laid the groundwork in continuing the abortion funds cutoff, placing his liberal approval on a piece of the right-wing agenda. If you give the devil a bone, he doesn't just go away. He wants the whole damn leg. So spare me all the moaning about Bush the Lesser. Those who want to turn Bush into some sort of cartoon monster have an agenda to keep most of us from seeing the beast they themselves have become. Of course, they hate Ralph Nader. He's a disquieting reminder of what could happen if we ever elect someone who will represent the bottom 90% in this country. Blame Nader, blame Bush, it's all part of the same distraction to keep you from focusing on one very important fact. Republican arsenic or Democratic arsenic, it really is the same damn crap being forced down your throat. But Bush will never figure out how to get away with this stuff the way Clinton did. He needs to take a page out of Clinton's big book of charm. Now, there was a guy who knew how to win people over. Whatever you thought of him, he was likable, smart, funny, and down to earth. He knew that the American people want to believe in their president. He discovered that saying something was the same as doing it. If you said you were for clean environment, that was good enough. You didn't have to do anything to make it a clean environment. Hell, you could get away with polluting it more, and most people would never know the difference. You could say you were pro-choice, and then preside over the largest wholesale closing of abortion clinics since the procedure became legal. What's the point of being pro-choice if in 86% of the counties in America there's not a single doctor who'll perform an abortion and not a single woman who can get one? Clinton learned that by talking a good feminist line, he could arrange it so that not one feminist leader would decry the order he signed in 1999 to deny federal funds to any foreign group that discussed abortion during consultations. Everyone thinks that was Bush's idea. That's how smart Clinton was. And that's why he got all the women's groups on his side, because he said he was with them. So, that's how you do it. Say one plausible thing, then do another. Or do nothing. The point of all this is that our real problem ultimately isn't Bush. It's the Democrats. Bush would be paralyzed if the Democrats started behaving like a true opposition party. Bush wouldn't even be there had one Democrat in the House stood up and challenged the votes of the Electoral College. But no one said anything. And for the better part of Bush's first year, it's Democrats who have been Bush's willing and necessary partners to madness. Start with the Bankruptcy Reform Act, which will make life much harder for working people who need to file for bankruptcy. Instead of having their debts expunged, this new law, passed by both houses of Congress and signed by Bush, will now force those who have lost everything to remain indebted to banks and credit card companies and find ways to pay them off. In other words, millions will never crawl out from under the rock of crushing debt. This bill was passed with the support of 37 Democratic senators, including every single female Democratic senator, all of whom sided with the banking industry instead of with America's working families. In an ironic twist, it was the millionaire Democrats in the Senate, Kennedy, Rockefeller, Corzine, Dayton, who voted against this repressive piece of legislation. Bill after bill that came from the Bush-occupied White House to the Congress found scores of Democrats with open arms. The Bush tax cut bill passed overwhelmingly with Democratic support, even though the bill was designed to benefit the richest 10% in the country. Democrats have also backed Bush on his bombing of Iraq and his aggressive actions toward China. In August 2001, the crowning moment of this collaboration came when the House voted to approve drilling for oil in the Alaskan wilderness. 34 Republicans had already jumped ship and said they would vote against their own party on this issue. That was stunning news to those who were concerned about our environment. But the joy soon subsided once the vote was taken and 36 Democrats voted in favor of the Bush plan. The saddest spectacle in this orgy of Democrats sleeping with the enemy was the way they approved every single one of Bush's cabinet nominations. Some appointees had the unanimous support of the Democrats in the Senate. Even controversial ones, like John Ashcroft, picked up a number of crucial Democratic votes. And not a single Democratic senator was willing to filibuster the way a rabid Republican would have if a Democratic president had selected such a fringe radical as Ashcroft to be attorney general. If I recall, Janet Reno was choice number 3 for Clinton. The first two nominees were rejected after Republicans went nuts over their views on nannies. But that's the difference. Democrats have no spine. They always back down. There's no one on their side of the aisle willing to go to battle for us the way a Tom DeLay or Trent Lott will for his side. Those guys will not rest until they win, no matter how many bodies the road is littered with. Democrats have become nothing more than Republican wannabes. So I propose a course of action. The Democrats must merge with the Republican Party. That way they can keep doing what they both do very well, representing the rich, and save a lot of money by consolidating staff and headquarters into one tight, fit fighting machine for the top 10%. The good news about such a merger? The working people of this country will finally get to have their own party. What's so terribly wrong with that? It'll be the second party of the two-party system, except it'll represent the other 90% of us. To speed things along, I now make this offer to the Democrats and Republicans. I will personally pay, out of my own pocket, for the legal charges and other fees to file the papers with the Federal Elections Commission, making the merger official, the all-new Democratic-Republican Party. As a gift, I'll even let you keep the ass, the Democrats' mascot, which you can breed with the Republican elephant. Now that ought to be fun. Therefore, I'm asking that by midnight on December 31st, 2001, the leaders of the Democratic Party turn over the keys to the party's headquarters at 430 South Capitol Street in Washington, D.C. to me or anybody else who wants to be responsible for the keys, because I'll probably lose them. There are about 200 plus million of us who would like to see a real two-party system, or three-party, or four-party. Hey, it's a big country. With one party fighting for the right to write off one's backyard tennis court as a business expense, and the other fighting for the right to see a doctor if one gets sick. It really is that simple. If the current Democratic leadership is unwilling to give me the keys, then I plan to file a class action suit on behalf of any of us who ever voted for a Democrat, charging fraud and trademark infringement. After all, these so-called Democrats are actually impersonating Republicans, and therefore committing a deception against the citizens who gave them the money, time, and votes. I will seek an injunction to prohibit them from continuing to use the word Democrat without Republican attached to it. The rest of us then can move on. We can call our party the New Democrats, or the Green Democrats, or the Free Beer Democrats. We'll work that out later in committee. Readers who wish to save me the cost of this lawsuit can promise to vote out all the phony Democrats and vote for honest progressive candidates fighting for the opposite of what the Republicans stand for. Meanwhile, to those Democratic officials who want to survive the political carnage ahead, I have one piece of advice for you. Quit moonlighting for the competition. That's my last bit of free advice to the party that sent 9 boys from my high school to their graves in Vietnam. If you can't clean up your act, fuck you and the donkey you rode in on. Chapter 11, The People's Prayer. I think it was Thomas Aquinas who once observed, "There's nothing like your own shit to make you realize how much you stink." In July 2001, Nancy Reagan, then keeping a round-the-clock watch at her husband's deathbed, dispatched former Reagan henchmen Michael Deaver and Kenneth Duberstein to Washington, D.C. with a private message to George W. Bush and the Republican leadership. The party had been divided over the issue of stem cell research, the ongoing science of taking stem cells from discarded human embryos and using those cells to treat people with debilitating conditions like Alzheimer's, the affliction that had visited former President Reagan, or find cures for other life-threatening diseases. The anti-abortion zealots, among whom are included the Reagans and the Bushes, who have controlled the party for decades, demanded that there be no embryonic research, regardless of the suffering of the living. W. had been leaning toward banning the research, telling the public in essence that he saw those dead embryos as living babies. I guess he feared that women would run out and fertilize their eggs just so they could get an embryo, have an abortion, and then sell the embryos for research. Such is the active fantasy life of the conservative nutcases who run this country. But now the nuts were coming unscrewed, as a number of conservatives, from Tommy Thompson to Connie Mack, were giving their approval to stem cell research, declaring that it had nothing to do with the taking of a human life. Suddenly, the media were full of stories of a conservative mutiny on the issue. Right to life went to war, to stop the flood toward reason. W., though, seemed unfazed and unmoved, more concerned with the brand of toothpaste the British Prime Minister was using than with changing his anti-abortion position. But then the word came from Nancy. The soon-to-be widow asked Bush to change his mind and approve, support, fund, and champion stem cell research. The research she relayed to him through her errand boys might save Ronnie or future Ronnies suffering from Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig's, and other catastrophic illnesses. Nancy had already been modifying her abortion stance over the past few years, and now she was coming out for the first time and saying, no, an embryo is not a human being. In that one moment, the entire playing field shifted. The call from the front office had been made. Screw the unborn. Save the Gipper. And sure enough, within days, Baby Bush's principles were disappearing faster than a Condit intern. Word came from the White House that now there was nothing wrong with certain stem cell research. Bush went on TV and would not say that a human embryo was a human being. After decades of cramming it down our throats that human life begins at conception, we were now being told by the same individuals who trashed a woman's right to an abortion that those unborn babies were actually nothing more than some dead embryonic tissue which might just keep some sick rich people alive a few more years. All over the country, Republican honchos joined in the call for more stem cell research. Orrin Hatch led the charge, saying, this is not a question of the destruction of human life. It's a question of facilitation of human life. Even Strom, only in cases of rape or incest, Thurman agreed, stem cell research could potentially treat and cure such maladies as multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, heart disease, various types of cancer, and diabetes. I am encouraged by this pioneering science and support federal funding for its research, said the old man, whose daughter, not so coincidentally, suffers from juvenile diabetes. There's nothing more lovable than an unembarrassed hypocrite from the right. They spend their entire lives making everyone else's life miserable. But as soon as a little misery enters their lives, then it's, belief system be damned, I want results. They devote all their energies for years to making it hard for blacks, chicks, or guys who like guys to get ahead and to be treated with an ounce of dignity. But the minute someone in their family is being held back, whoa, you better get out of my kid's way, Buster. He's special. Reagan, Bush, Cheney, and the whole lot of them are responsible for decades of cruel legislation designed to punish the poor, imprison those with health problems, drug addictions, or strip rights from desperate people here in America illegally. But when they find themselves in a desperate situation, suddenly they have the compassion of St. Francis and the mercy of Mother Teresa. The rich and powerful make it their mission in life to destroy our air, poison our water, rip us off, and make it impossible for us to get any sort of help at the customer service window. But when their actions come back to haunt them, they aren't spooked. They're looking for a handout. Well, I say that's a good thing. Let's hope they get all they're looking for. If it takes a personal tragedy for them to come to their senses, so be it. After all, in spite of their 7-bathroom houses and garages full of Bentleys, they're just like us. They are H-U-M-A-N. And when a loved one of theirs is lying in bed constantly soiling their adult diapers, pissing all over the new designer sheets, and blabbering on like the crippled souls whose care and funding they just cut from the federal budget, well, in times like these, rich or poor, pus from facial sores all starts looking the same. Equality achieved, one nation, incapacitated, justice for all. So now, thanks to Ronald Reagan's misfortune, we're going to get a little federally funded stem cell research, maybe even find a cure for Alzheimer's and God knows what else. Just think about that for a minute. This is what it takes today to get a little responsible scientific research funded. Our beloved former leader, who helped ruin the lives of millions of women because he thought those embryos were little tykes, now finds himself in a debilitating pickle. And just because hordes of conservatives consider him a saint, millions of average Americans will finally be relieved of their suffering. This phenomenon, the well-heeled changing their tune as soon as they become the victims, is happening everywhere. In New York City, Republican Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, who for years opposed the city paying for health care for uninsured children, did an abrupt about-face after he came down with cancer. I have to admit, a humble Giuliani explained to the press, Once I got cancer, I began to see a lot of things in a new light. Or take Big Dick Cheney. Cheney quietly halts any anti-gay initiatives that may come from the White House. Why? Because his daughter is a lesbian. Where would Dick Cheney stand on this issue if a loved one of his weren't gay? Probably not too far down that road in Wyoming where Matthew Shepard was left to die on a cross of fence posts. These faggots and fairies take on a whole new dimension when one of them sprang from your loins. The day his daughter came out of the closet was at least one day Dick Cheney stopped being a fat cat Republican and responded like a human being and a father. When it hits home, it's very hard to keep acting like an asshole. So I've decided that the only hope we have in this country to bring aid to the sick, protection to the victims of discrimination, and a better life to those who suffer is to pray like crazy that those in power are afflicted with the worst possible diseases, tragedies, and circumstances in life. Because I can guarantee you, as soon as it's their ass on the line, we're all on the way to being saved. With that in mind, I've written a prayer to speed the recovery of all those in need by asking God to smite every political leader and corporate executive with some form of deadly disease. I know it isn't nice to ask God to bring harm to others, but I'd like to think that God is not only merciful and just, he also has a highly developed sense of irony. I think he'd like to see a little grief come to those who have abused his planet and his children. So I have written a prayer to afflict the comfortable with as many afflictions as possible. After all, history tells us that God enjoys a good old-fashioned smiting every now and then, and who better to smite than the stupid white types who got us into this mess? Please pray this prayer with me each morning, preferably before the opening bell of the NYSE. It matters not what religion you claim or if you claim none at all. This prayer is non-discriminatory, portable, and requires no collection plate. Half of Africa will soon be dying of AIDS. 12 million kids in America today do not get to eat the food they need. Texas is still executing innocent citizens. Times are wasting. Bow your heads and join with me now. A prayer to afflict the comfortable. Dear Lord, God, Yahweh, Buddha, Bob, nobody, we beseech you, O merciful one, to bring comfort to those who suffer today for whatever reason you, nature, or the World Bank has deemed appropriate. We realize, O Heavenly Father, that you cannot cure all the sick at once. That would surely empty out the hospitals the good nuns have established in your name. And we accept that you, the omniscient one, cannot eliminate all the evil in the world, for that would surely put thee out of a job. Rather, dear Lord, we ask that you inflict every member of the House of Representatives with horrible, incurable cancers of the brain, penis, and hand, though not necessarily in that order. We ask, our loving Father, that every senator from the South be rendered addicted to drugs and find himself locked away for life. We beseech you to make the children of every senator in the Mountain Time Zone gay, really gay. Put the children of senators from the East in a wheelchair, and the children of senators from the West in a public school. We employ, most merciful one, just as you turned Lot's wife into a pillar of salt, that you turn the rich, all the rich, into paupers and homeless, wiping out their entire savings assets and mutual funds. Remove from them their positions of power, and yea, may they walk through the valley and into the darkness of a welfare office. Condemn them to a life of flipping burgers and dodging bill collectors. Let them hear the wailing of the innocents as they sit in the middle seat of row 43 and coach, and let them feel the gnashing of teeth that are abscessed and rotted like the 108 million who have no dental coverage. Heavenly Father, we pray that all white leaders, especially the alumni of Bob Jones University, who believe black people have it good these days, be risen from their sleep tomorrow morning with their skin as black as a stretch limo, so that they may enjoy the riches and reap the bountiful fruits of being black in America. We humbly request that your anointed ones, the bishops of the Holy Roman Catholic Church, be smitten with ovaries and unplanned pregnancies and a pamphlet about the rhythm method. Finally, dear Lord, we call upon you to have Jack Welch swim the Hudson he has polluted, to force Hollywood's executives to sit and watch their own movies over and over and over, to have Jesse Helms kissed on the lips by a man of his own gender, to make Chris Matthews go mute, to let the air quickly out of Bill O'Reilly and turn to ash all who are responsible for those who smoke in my office. Oh, yes, and unleash with a fury a plague of locusts to nest in the toupee of the Senate Minority Leader from the great state of Mississippi. May you hear our prayers and grant them, O King of Kings, who sits on high and watches over us as best you can, considering what screw-ups we are. Grant us some relief from our misery and suffering, as we know that the men you shall smite will be swift in their efforts to rid themselves of their misfortune, which in turn may rid us of ours. With this we pray, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit who used to be a ghost. Amen. Epilogue, Tallahassee, Hi-Ho. I have a confession to make. I am the person responsible for the presidency of George W. Bush, me, Michael Moore. I could have prevented it all. Now I've made a lot of people angry and the country's in a crapper. That's why I'm in hiding. I'm writing this epilogue from my bunker in the woods of northern Michigan, somewhere along the 45th parallel. The locals say that I'm sitting exactly halfway between the equator and the North Pole, but to me it feels like a million miles from nowhere. I'm no longer thinking about how we can save the country or the planet. My only concern now is how to save my own sorry ass. It all started in Tallahassee. Tallahassee, Florida. Yes, that Tallahassee. My presence in the state capital of Florida had nothing to do with the 36-day media circus that followed the 2000 election. That little piece of slow-mo roadkill was for those who hadn't had their O.J. Monica fix for a while and desperately needed to watch one more ugly seam of the nation unravel like a Newt Gingrich marriage. That was not what brought me to Tallahassee, and I was there for none of those 37 days. I landed in Tallahassee 15 days before the election. What I didn't count on was a pre-dawn meeting with the governor of Florida, Jeb Bush. Just him and me on a dark street in downtown Tallahassee, his bodyguards lurking nearby, ready at a moment's notice to eat me for breakfast. I'd gone to Florida to try and stop his brother from winning the election, to ward off a disaster that loomed on the horizon, to defeat the enemy. 20 seconds over Tallahassee. It was a mission destined to fail. As a result of my actions, I don't know whom I should fear more, the oil men who now run the corporation known as the United States of America from inside the Oval Office, or the deranged liberals who want my head because they think I was somehow the mastermind behind the Nader campaign, and that okay, all right, it's true. It was me. Yes, me. It's all my fault. What was I thinking? Did I really want to meet Susan Sarandon that badly? Oh, God, forgive me. I've wrecked the country, this wonderful psycho nation of idealists and accountants who only want the right to drive their Chevy Blazers across the fruited plain, whose only request is to someday be told the difference between partly sunny and partly cloudy, who seek nothing more than a cellular plan with enough peak time free minutes so they'll always be ready if one of their kids should call from inside a school shooting because they need mommy or daddy to phone CNN immediately and start negotiating the rights to the really cool footage they're shooting right now of the carnage in the cafeteria. Somehow, I think I can outwit the thugs from Halliburton and Enron, now referred to as special assistants to the vice president. They will be contained, quarantined, and put out of their misery soon enough. But no amount of contrition will satisfy the Gestapo, who are rightly upset that their man has been barred from the office he won. They're brimming with anger. I have to tell you, I have not seen liberals this angry since. Well, I don't think I've really ever seen liberals get too worked up about anything. After all, it's not like they're the Christian right, who have managed, with God and insanity on their side, to always get their way. Except now all these liberals agree finally on one thing, blaming Ralph Nader and blaming me. Why blame me? They don't know the whole story. Ralph Nader fired me in 1988, kicked me out in the street, penniless. Now, in order to survive, to protect the ones I love, and to get this book I've written out to those of you lucky enough to find it, amid the latest literature from our national wrestling heroes. I have retreated deep into the forest with my laptop and my compass, living off the land the way nature intended, jotting down my final thoughts in the hopes that some lessons can be learned. Last week, while I was changing planes in Detroit, a guy with a big smile on his face comes up to me, puts out his hand, and offers this greeting. "Everyone says you're an asshole, so I just wanted to meet you." He turned and ran, missing my response. "Everybody is right." The whole state of Michigan is full of people like this, honest and polite. Like the letter I got today, a letter similar to many I've received of late. "Dear Jerk," it read, "I hope you're satisfied with what you've done. You and that egomaniac Ralph Nader will have us all drinking arsenic in our water before we know it. Do us a favor. Drop dead." Well, I could write back and tell him that Ralph Nader is responsible for nothing other than inspiring over 1 million new voters to come to the polls, because he was the only candidate to tell the truth about what is happening to this country. The rich made out like bandits during the Democratic years of the 1990s. Absolutely nothing has been done to alleviate the hardships faced by 45 million Americans who have no health coverage. The minimum wage remains unchanged at a slave wage of $5.15 an hour. I could tell him that because Ralph Nader was on the ballot in the state of Washington, the majority of those 101,906 citizens who voted for Nader also voted for the Democrat for U.S. Senate. Thanks to these Nader voters, Maria Cantwell became Washington's new senator by only 2,229 votes. If you're going to blame Nader for taking votes from Gore in Florida, then you must also give credit to Nader for bringing thousands of new voters to the polls who made the difference for Cantwell, thus allowing the Democrats to force a 50-50 tie in the Senate. Then, once there was a tie, one senator from Vermont realized he suddenly had a lot of power and used it to turn the Senate over to the Democrats by leaving the Republican Party. None of that could have happened without Nader. I could remind my correspondent that the only people who cost Gore the election he rightfully won were the five justices of the Supreme Court who had not let all the votes be counted. And I could point out that Gore never would have found himself in a jam he was in had he won his own state, or won Clinton's home state, or won decisively at least one of the three debates. Gore did none of that, and that's what put him in the jam he found himself in. And to Gore's credit, he has not blamed Ralph Nader. He blames the zipper on Clinton's pants. I could write back and tell my friendly correspondent all of this, but I won't. Instead, I'd like to tell him and you a story that until now I've only told a few close friends, a story about my 14 hours in hell in a place called Tallahassee. I avoid Florida. It's so sticky and humid that you have to carry around a roll of the quicker picker-upper just to stay dry. The state is full of bugs and mosquitoes. They kidnap little Cuban boys and won't return them to their fathers. It's like every day is hunting season for German tourists in rental cars. Then there's Walt Disney World and Gloria Estefan. The Kennedys running around in their freshly changed underwear in West Palm Beach, not to mention hurricanes, Bebe Rebozo, Ted Bundy, Anita Bryant, swamps, cheap guns, and the National Enquirer. I hate Florida. Yet something deep inside was compelling me to go down there as the November election drew near. Maybe it was just something I ate. Maybe not. I'd been asked to come and speak to the student body at Florida State University. At first I had said yes, but later had to cancel due to the shooting schedule on my film. Then Al Gore failed to win the third and final debate with George W. Bush. Now, where I come from, the smart guy wins in a debate, the dumb guy loses. It really is that simple. But not this time. I couldn't believe my eyes. It was clear that Al Gore was doing everything he could to lose the election. I called the people back at Florida State and Tallahassee to see if I was still welcome, and they were more than happy to accommodate me. A date was set for me to address the student body the following week, now just 2 weeks before Election Day. I would also hold a press conference for the statewide media and make an announcement. I had something I wanted to say about Ralph Nader. My relationship with Ralph is a complicated one. I had once worked in his office back in the late 80s. He'd given me a job when I was unemployed, and this generous act was something I resolved to never forget. From my cubicle next to Ralph's office on the second floor of a building built by Andrew Carnegie, I published a Media Watch newsletter, modestly called Moore's Weekly. I also started shooting what would become Roger and Me. Everything was fine until the day I signed a deal with a publisher to write a book about General Motors. When Ralph heard the news of my good fortune, he wasn't breaking out the $50 cigars. "What makes you qualified to write a book about General Motors?" he demanded. He also wanted to know by what right I was making this film, why I was spending more time in Flint than in D.C., and why wasn't that newsletter being published more regularly. Finally, he peered down at me and just shook his head in pity. "Well, you can take Mike out of Flint," he offered derisively, "but you can't take the Flint out of Mike." He asked that I pack up and leave. I was crushed. I found a place to edit my film and moved on. When the movie came out as a show of support and no hard feelings, I called Ralph and offered to give his projects the proceeds from my Washington premiere. He refused the offer. Instead, he and an associate trashed me in the New York Times. I was crushed again, two crushes, and I got the message. I didn't speak to him for the next 8 years. By the late 90s, I figured it was time to give him a call. I must have been not getting enough rejection in my life. I invited him and his staff to attend the opening of my latest film, the big one. They did. I stood in the back of the theater and watched Ralph having a good time and a hearty laugh. Afterward, I had him stand and take a bow, which was received by loud and enthusiastic applause. On the way out, I gave him a hug. Ralph is not a hugger. Actually, neither am I. I guess I saw it in a movie somewhere, and it looked cool. 2 years later, I'm sitting on the porch in Michigan minding my own business when Ralph calls and asks that I endorse him for President of the United States. I try not to endorse politicians because, well, for the same reason you don't. They're all so slick, they have bad hair, they can't get through two sentences without telling a lie. Ralph was none of these things, just a cranky genius. In other words, not presidential material. In 1996, he put his name on the ballot and then did virtually no campaigning. It was a big letdown to those who supported him. Was he serious this time? Yes, he told me. This time it was the real thing. He was going to raise a good chunk of money, and he was committed to visiting all 50 states. He would have a full-time staff. Lucky them. I wanted to get off the phone and go back to doing nothing. I didn't want to get mixed up in all the hoo-ha I knew would come from such a run. But what was my choice? Pretend the country was in great shape? Put my faith in one of the major party candidates who were being funded by the same big shots I spend my time fighting and filming? Sit in Michigan and feed the squirrels? I couldn't let Ralph down. He had not let me down a long time ago, and he had never let the country down. If his voice wasn't heard during this election, then none of the issues we care deeply about would ever get mentioned, let alone debated. Before saying yes, I decided to send a personal letter to Al Gore, giving him a chance to explain himself and tell me why I should even think of voting for him, considering the Clinton-Gore record. He sent me back a four-page letter, the kind where the first paragraph and the last sentence are personalized and the rest is spit out at you from a computer. He thanked me for my provocative letter and then went on to repeat his positions, which I already knew. Although I had kept an open mind, nothing he said convinced me that we were going to see anything different out of him if he made it to the Oval Office. I called Ralph and told him I was on board, as long as I didn't have to wear a gray suit, eat hummus, or gut a whale. Ralph's campaign was distributing a column by Molly Ivins that offered advice to those who would like to vote for Nader but didn't want to put George W. Bush in the White House. If they lived in a state where either Gore or Bush was expected to win by a wide margin, she suggested then they should use their vote to send a message and give it to Ralph Nader. But if they lived in one of the states where the election was close, then they must vote for Gore to block Bush. Me, I normally vote for whoever I think is the best candidate, just like I was taught in seventh grade civics. But what do I know? Privately, I think most of the people in the Nader camp thought what I thought, that once Gore had a chance to wipe the floor with Bush in a debate, the election would be over. So we figured, let's get out millions of votes for Nader to show the next president, Al Gore, that there's a large number of Americans who don't want him pushing the Democratic Party further to the right. A strong vote for Nader might be a way to check Gore and his promise to do things like spend more on the military and less on jobs. Yeah, we were real geniuses. Then came the debates. Ralph was shut out of them, which left America with three 90-minute shows in which Gore and Bush agreed with each other more than they disagreed. In the second debate, the two of them said they agreed with each other on 37 different issues. It was stunning to watch. Gore had blown it. He had failed to unmask Bush's ignorance and stupidity. He had failed to set himself apart and show the nation there was a real difference on the ballot. He had three chances to nuke that smirking son of a Bush, and he couldn't do it. Message to the country: if this is how he caves with Junior, what will happen when he gets in a room with the Russians or the Canadians? I was shocked by the implications. It was starting to look as if Gore would lose. He was going to lose his home state. He was going to lose Clinton's home state. He couldn't convince the Democratic dean of the Senate, Robert Byrd of West Virginia, to endorse him until 5 days before the election, thus sacrificing West Virginia, a traditional Democratic stronghold, to Bush. Any one of these states would have given Gore all the electoral votes he would need to win the White House. Gore was imploding. And Nader voters everywhere were like rats jumping off a sinking ship. Nice rats, though, the lovable, fluffy kind. Ralph saw his poll numbers cut in half. It appeared that he would not get the 5% necessary to receive federal matching funds at the next election. Things at Nader Central went crazy. A decision was made to disavow the Ivins plan and go out on a second tour of states where Gore might win or lose by a percentage point, and Ralph's presence would make all the difference. In some of these states, Nader's poll numbers were as high as 12%. It was a bold, in-your-face strategy that said to the Democrats, "You have deserted your base. You are no longer Democrats. It is now time you were taught a lesson." Nothing like a good switch to the buttocks from Headmaster Nader. "Look, we all know the only thing a politician fears is being removed from that nice, cozy office with the interns and the expense account. That, and the prospect of having to get a real job. If you don't hold that over their heads, they will never behave, never listen to us, never get out of bed in the morning and show up for work." Ralph Nader represented the country's only hope of pushing Gore toward doing the right thing. Everyone knew this effort to barnstorm in the swing states would cost Gore the election and put Bush in the White House. But when you've seen the administration you voted for side more often with the Republicans than the traditional Democrats, when you've watched as these Democrats make life harder for the poor, paving the way for the rich to have their biggest orgy in history, when my hometown ends up losing more GM jobs during the 8 years of Clinton-Gore than during those 12 years of Reagan-Bush, well, here's your choice. Do you want to get fucked by someone who tells you they're going to fuck you, or do you want to get fucked by someone who lies to you and then fucks you? I'm sorry for the language, but that's probably the nicest way to explain how I and millions of other Americans saw this election. You don't have to agree. You don't have to like it. You just have to read that sentence one more time if you want to even come close to comprehending the level of our anger. I know a lot of good people could see no other way but to vote for the Democrat. They would rather be told, "I love you," while getting screwed, than have to look at the face of the beast on top of them for the next 4 years. I know that feeling. Tell me that you love me, and you can do just about anything to me, including trashing me in the New York Times. But these reluctant Democrats for Gore were really our allies. They wanted many of the same things we did. They just took a different path. My attitude was, if Bush won, we were going to have to work with these well-meaning liberals to save the world from the lesser Bush. It was not right to just tell them to go to hell. So I told the Nader staff, "Hey, there's no reason to purposely piss these people, our friends or potential friends, off. Our fight is with those who have stolen the name Democrat, the party hacks, the lobbyists, the weasels who somehow couldn't cut it in the Republican Party because they didn't have what it takes to destroy a national forest or close 1,000 libraries or take free breakfast away from the malnourished little ones in the inner city. You have to have real guts to do stuff like that, and you have to enjoy it. Those who don't get jobs over at the Democratic Party. Our fight wasn't with the core voters who still feel some desperate connection to what is called the Democratic Party. The fact that millions of Americans still hold out hope that the Democrats are going to represent their interests better than the Republicans is more a comment on our failure to show the country just how similar these two parties are and how the Democrats will sell them out nearly every time. The Nader campaign asked me to go with them on this tour of the swing states in the final weeks before the election. I declined. I told them I would rather work hard in those states where Ralph could get a lot of votes without being responsible for Bush winning the election. Why not spend our energies in New York and Texas, where the outcome is clearly known? Tell people in those states not to waste their votes on Gore. They will have zero impact. But they could send a strong message if Nader were to pull down 10% of the vote. That was not the strategy that had been decided. They respected my decision and wished me well. I landed in Tallahassee on the afternoon of October 23, 2000. A student from Florida State, his brother and his sister-in-law, picked me up at the airport, and as we walked toward the car, they started asking about the invite they heard I had extended Jeb Bush. "Everyone's talking about it," they told me. "What invite are you talking about?" I asked. "The one you made in the paper yesterday." They handed me a copy of Sunday's Tallahassee Democrat, the city's daily paper, and there on the front page of a section was an interview I had done with a reporter the week before on the phone from New York, a big picture of me and a quote challenging the governor to show up and face me on the stage that night. Oh, Mr. Tough Guy, real easy to throw down the gauntlet when you're 1,000 miles away, isn't it? Of course, it's a whole other thing when you're suddenly all alone in a state full of people who don't take kindly to smart-ass Northerners. But I wasn't thinking that far ahead. I arrived at the university and began the press conference. I was nervous. I didn't want any misunderstandings over what I was about to say. I told the media present that Bush had to be stopped. I appealed to the people in Florida that if Gore was their man, then by all means they should get out and vote for him. But if you were voting for Nader, I wanted you to think long and hard about your vote. The stakes, I felt, would be different in Florida. If it's more important to you to stop Bush, then you might have to vote for Gore. I would understand and respect your decision. The reporters were a bit surprised. Was I switching my vote to Gore? No, I said, I'm voting for Ralph. Of course, that's easy for me to say. I live in a state where Gore is already going to win by a landslide. But if you live in Florida, things are different. The story went out across the state that one of Ralph Nader's celebrity backers had given the green light to vote for Gore in Florida if that's what voters thought was the right thing to do. When the press conference finished, I ran into the bathroom and got sick. It was time for me to go on stage. An overflow crowd of 2,000 people packed the auditorium. The organizer banged on the door. "We need to start," she shouted. "Just give me a few minutes," I replied. I got sicker. Another bang on the door. "Show them a segment from my TV show," I said. "I'll be okay in a minute." I didn't know if I was sick because of this horrible pressure I felt or because I'd been treated to a Whataburger burger, a Tallahassee favorite on the way into town. Maybe I just knew that the whole election, the whole country, was in the shit can with me, and there was no escape for any of us. 20 minutes late, I walked onto the stage. The Greens were all sitting down front, Nader signs in hand. I told them and the rest of the audience that there was a bitter pill I knew some of them wanted to swallow. I told the crowd, "You have to use your best judgment. Follow your conscience. Please know that I will think no less of you if you feel you have to vote for Gore. I will still be voting for Nader," I said, and went over the litany of reasons why it was a matter of conscience for me. I cannot ever vote for someone who believes in the execution of other human beings, who believes that we should continue the weekly bombing of civilians in other countries, who thinks the minimum wage should go up by only $1 an hour, who wants to sign additional trade agreements like NAFTA so that even more Americans can lose their jobs. I told the crowd that I couldn't pull the lever or punch the hole for Gore. A man who wanted to spend more on the military than Bush did, who wouldn't seek guaranteed health care for all our citizens immediately, who thought that Janet Reno was wrong to return little Elian Gonzalez to Cuba. That's who Al Gore was. But I said, "I understand your unique dilemma here in Florida, so don't listen to me. Do what you think is best. We'll sort it all out later." And God bless these Nader kids down front here for their courage and dedication, something that many of their 60s-era parents had long ago snuffed. The Q&A that followed the speech, plus another discussion in the student union afterward with a couple hundred students and community activists, some of whom had driven 3 hours to be there, was a powerful back and forth about how to handle the coming deluge. By the time it was over, it was 1:30 a.m., 5.5 hours after I had resolved my issues with the Whataburger. I left with the sense that a storm was brewing here in Florida, and it might be wise to take cover. I was driven to my hotel, a quaint little place that sat on the pedestrian mall leading up the block to the state capitol building. I turned on the TV and watched a replay of the 11 o'clock news. "A chief Nader backer says Bush must be stopped no matter what," the anchor said. I turned out the lights and went to sleep. I awoke at 6:30 a.m. to catch my plane home. A student was waiting downstairs to drive me to the airport. As I was checking out at the counter, the kid yelled, "Governor Bush just walked by." "Stop him," I shouted, without thinking really. Perhaps it was a reflex, whether I'm in Texas or Florida. When I hear the words "Governor Bush," I instinctively respond with a "Stop him." The kid opened the door and called out, "Governor Bush, there's someone who would like to meet you." By that time, I was already out the door. There on this deserted pedestrian mall, which looked like a dark alley in the final minutes before dawn, were Governor Jeb Bush and his bodyguard, walking to work. A black SUV carrying more security was creeping along the car-free street about 40 feet behind the governor. Bush turned to see who was asking for him, and then saw me standing there. He gave that Bush smirk and began walking back toward me. I moved toward him, and the bodyguard went into standby to beat the punk to a pulp mode. "Mr. Moore," Bush said, shaking his head like he'd just been fed the same plate of sloppy joes for the third day in a row. I held out my hand, and Bush took it. "Just wanted to shake your hand and say hi, Governor," I said politely. He squeezed tightly, not wanting to let go until he had said what he had to say. His eyes were like needles that locked right on mine. The bodyguard moved closer. "So, did they pay you enough to come down here?" he snapped at me pointedly. And the translation was clear. "You suck, Moore." My mouth went dry. My heart was beating so hard I was worried he could hear it. "It's never enough, Governor. You know that," I replied with the first words I could muster. Why did he care who paid me or how much? Then it dawned on me. He paid for it. Florida State University. No wonder he was pissed. He'd picked up the tab for my visit to tell thousands of Floridians, especially Nader voters, that beating Bush was the important thing. This was not what the Bush camp wanted Naderites to be thinking. Had he seen the news from the night before? Bush glared at me and withdrew his hand. "Kevin with you?" he asked me suddenly. "Huh? Kevin?" Was this some secret code word to alert the bodyguard that it was time to Linda Blair my neck? Then it hit me. He was asking about his cousin, Kevin Rafferty, the filmmaker who'd helped me out with Roger and me. I hadn't worked with Kevin in 12 years. Why was he asking me this? I didn't know what to say. "Oh, no, he's not here," I mumbled. "Well, give him my best," he said. "Sure," I responded. "Leaving, are you?" he asked. "Yes," I replied. "Right now." "Good." He gave me that famous Bush smirk again, nodded his head as if to say good riddance, and then turned and left. As he walked down the deserted alley, I tried to think of some witty comeback, but he was already 20 paces ahead of me. The black SUV rolled down its window. The state trooper inside sized me up, then slowly drove past my feet. The first light of day was making its way over the Capitol Dome. I would not see this place again until I saw it on nonstop television 2 weeks later. Every time I've run into one of the Bush kids, it's been a defeating, debilitating experience. For some reason, they always seem to get the upper hand. When I came across George W. in Iowa and tried to ask him a question for my TV show, he shouted at me to go find real work. The entire crowd in the place roared with laughter. I didn't know what to say. He was right. This isn't real work. I had no comeback. The day I ran into Neil Bush, the unindicted co-conspirator in the Silverado savings and loan scandal, I was in the lobby of General Motors in Detroit doing a radio interview. He walked through the door with those four Asian guys, bankers from Taiwan, he later told me. When he spotted me, he freaked out. I was the last person he expected to see at General Motors. "Where's your camera?" he demanded, his eyes darting all over the place. "Oh, I don't have the camera with me today," I said sheepishly and regretfully. A big smile beamed across his face. "Oh, Mikey didn't bring his camera." He reached out and pinched my cheek. "Too bad." He walked away laughing and explaining to the Chinese guys who I was and how he just put one over on me. The only bush I've been able to reduce to a pulp, I say with shame, is the only girl, their sister, Dorothy. She's sweet. She's a mom. And she had no idea what to say when I asked her which of her brothers she thought would win the let's see who can kill more inmates on death row race, George or Jeb. She was visibly offended. In truth, she looked genuinely hurt by the implication that her brothers are cold-blooded killers. She looked as if she was going to cry. I felt like a jerk. Way to go, Mike. You finally took a bush down. Of course, there is one other bush brother, Marvin, though you wouldn't know it from the media. I've never met Marvin. You have never met Marvin. No one has ever met Marvin. God knows where he is or what he's up to, other than planning how to get one over on me. After the chilling encounter with Jeb, I boarded my plane to L.A., unable to get the episode out of my head. Then, as I was trying to open the bag of honey-roasted peanuts, a bolt of something struck me, and it wasn't the guy's seat 3 inches in front of me. I got on one of those expensive airphones and called Ralph. I spoke to the three people who were running his campaign, aware there was a chance the man himself was also listening in. "Guys," I said, "has it crossed your mind that the most powerful man in America today is Ralph Nader?" Silence on the other end of the phone. "I'm serious. His 5% is going to make the difference. Bush, more than anything else this week, needs Nader to do well in order for him to win. And Gore needs Nader out of the way in order for him to win. If Ralph wasn't in the race, Gore would win. Only one man can call the shots here. Only one candidate has any real say today. And that's Ralph Nader." I continued. "But after November 7th, that power is gone. The power is only good for the week or so, as Gore and Bush see all their plans hanging on the actions of one man, Ralph Nader. Why not use this position of power for some good?" "What did you have in mind?" asked one of them. "Ralph holds Gore's future in his hands. What if he were to call Gore and say, 'Hey, you want to be president? This is what you have to do by noon tomorrow.' And then give Gore a laundry list to pick from. Universal health care, an end to the phony drug war, no tax cuts for the rich, whatever. Ralph asks nothing for himself, no cabinet position, no funding for his projects. He just wants Gore to do the right thing. And if Gore publicly commits to doing so, then Ralph goes on TV and says, 'We've made our point. We have helped Al Gore see the need for X, Y, or Z. He's told the nation he's committed to doing that. So next Tuesday, if you live in one of the swing states and you're supporting me, I want you to vote for Gore. The rest of you in the other 40 states, I still need your vote so that we can build a viable third party to keep Gore's feet to the fire. In other words, declare victory. After all, the reason Ralph's running in the first place to push the political agenda more our way will have been accomplished. What do you think?" "We can't count on getting our 5% unless we get every vote we can in every state," the campaign manager responded. "We can't give up a single vote at this point." But the day after you get the 5%, I replied, "that's all you'll have. 5% of the vote and 0% of the power. Today, though, we hold all the power. One candidate needs Nader in, the other needs Nader out. This election is going to be decided by a percentage point or two. Ralph holds anywhere from 2 to 5%. Today, right now, you and Ralph get to say who the next president is going to be. You will never have this kind of power in your hands again, the rest of your lives." A longtime Nader colleague who was on the call understood what I was trying to say. "But you're never going to get Ralph to back down," he said. "It will look like he gave in when things got too hot. Plus, the Democrats have treated him with such disrespect, you'll never convince him that he should help them with anything. Plus," he continued, "what makes you think Gore would keep his promise? These people keep no promises." "What about all those thousands of kids on the campuses who have worked so hard?" the campaign manager chimed in. "What about the tens of thousands who came to the rallies you and Ralph spoke at? What about them?" Here's their first experience with electoral politics, and the candidate they gave everything for just throws in the towel near the end. You can't do that to them. It will only turn them into cynical adults who won't want to get involved in an election again. That certainly made a lot of sense. The last thing I wanted to do was to add to the cynical hordes who've given up any interest in voting at all. But, I offered, isn't there a way we can do this so it is accepted for what it is? A victory for the Greens, for Ralph, for everyone who's worked for him? Because by getting Gore to change his positions, we've succeeded in a way we never thought possible. You know, it's like that ultra-conservative party in Israel that has only, like, 5 seats in the Knesset, but their 5 votes are always needed to form a majority government. Whichever party gives them the most of what they want on their agenda gets their votes. If they join with the liberals to form the government, their ultra-conservative supporters don't get mad at them and accuse them of selling out. Just the opposite. They're hailed as heroes because although they're only 5 votes, they get their way every time. Wow, that was profound, I said to myself, teaching political science at 30,000 feet. Mike, a voice on the phone replied, are you okay? This is not the Israeli Knesset. You're in the United States. That's not how it works here. Ralph will be crucified if he backs Gore, and Gore will be crucified if he changes his positions at such a late date. It's not going to happen. I told them I understood. I reminded them that Ralph didn't have to drop out, just throw the vote to Gore in a few swing states, that's all. Gore would owe him big time once he was in the White House. We could have our cake and eat it too. No one seemed interested in any cake. I thanked them for listening and hung up from the $140 call. Then I sank down in my seat and ordered my first drink ever on a plane. Somewhere over Texas, I fell asleep. What happened on November 7, 2000 will now always have its own page in the history books. Nader was polling 6% in Florida the day before I arrived. The day after I left, it was down to 4%. And by election day, it had dropped to 1.6% of the vote. But that represented 97,488 Nader votes in Florida. Would at least 538 of these voters change their vote if they had known on November 7th that their specific votes were the ones that would make the difference? Of course they would. I'm curious, though, why those upset at Nader have directed none of their anger toward the other candidates from the left who also appeared on the Florida presidential ballot. David McReynolds of the Socialist Party got 622 votes. James Harris of the Socialist Worker Party, who got 562 votes. Or Monica Moorhead of the Workers' World Party, who got 1,804 votes. Surely there were 538 voters among that group who would have held their nose and voted for Gore had they known Bush and his cronies were going to swipe the election. Personally, that's who I blame, Monica Moorhead. That's the one thing we learned from the 90s. It's always Monica. And forgive me, it's always Moorhead. So blame Monica. Don't blame Ralph. And don't blame me. Or do blame me. Yes, in fact, if the Democrats are insisting on giving that much power to the Naderites, then maybe we should take it. Yes, it was us. We did it. We are the mighty Thor, all-powerful and all-knowing. We will destroy all in our path. Change your ways or we will turn you into ash. It was not we who abandoned the Democratic Party. It was you. You deserted us and all those who once believed Democrats stood for something like fighting for the rights of working people. But you hopped in bed with the Republicans, and we had no choice but to follow our conscience and vote for Ralph Nader. That is the way of Thor. So, yes, we denied you the White House. We tossed your ass out of Washington, and we will do it again. We have over 900 campus green organizations. We have a mailing list of over 200,000 aggressive active volunteers. We won 22 races around the country in the 2000 election, and they joined the 53 other elected Greens who held various offices across the country. Since last November, the Greens have won another 16 seats, making a total of 91 Greens currently holding elective office in America. 5 cities in California are now run by Green Party mayors, and most significantly, the number of Americans who voted for Nader in 2000 increased by a whopping 500% over those who voted for him in 1996. This is a growing movement. And it's not just about the Green Party. Heck, I'm not even a member. There are millions of people who have had it with the Democrats and Republicans and who want a real choice. That's why a professional wrestler won as governor of Minnesota. That's why Vermont's only congressman is an independent, and now so is one of its senators. There will be more independents in the coming years. It can't be helped. Actually, that's not true. It has been helped greatly by the actions in action of the Democratic Republican Party. So, run for your lives. I'm coming out of my bunker. I'm sick of just surviving, of taking crap from the whiners who will never be there on the front lines for the have-nots, risking arrest, taking a billy club to the head, giving a few hours of their time each week to be citizens, the highest honor to hold in a democracy. I want us all to face our fears and stop behaving like our goal in life is to merely survive. Surviving is for wimps and game show contestants stranded in the jungle or on a desert island. You are not stranded. You own the store. The bad guys are just a bunch of silly, stupid white men. And there's a hell of a lot more of us than there are of them. Use your power. You deserve better.
Copyright 2002, New Millennium Audio, a division of New Millennium Entertainment, Incorporated. Produced by Deborah Raffin and Michael Wiener.